And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Today marks the beginning of the official countdown to the 2008 presidential elections, which will be held exactly 1 year from today. A lot's riding on the outcome of this fight. This main event could prove to be the ultimate title match to determine who will be the champion of the world. That's coming up. But first, we feature a grudge match as past heavyweight champion Smokin' Dave Foreman returns to the ring. That's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
All right, so it's not the perfect metaphor, but Dave Foreman is getting upset about the way certain people are treating the West he loves. You'll be hearing from Dave, who battles now to keep the wild wild. He is our focus on the weekly Earth Summit, coming up in just a minute. And in segment two, have you noticed the mainstream media this week? Everyone's going green. NBC is sending its lead journalist to the ends of the earth. CNN recently spent a week focused on the earth in peril. People are getting the message. If you haven't begun planning for sustainability in your personal life, you'd better start now. We'll be talking with the manager of the National Solar Tour that's featuring people across America who are doing the right thing. Right now, building solar and clean technologies into their homes and communities. That's coming up in segment two. A great show ahead, and as promised, it's now time for the weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. Today, we're going to hear from the legendary Dave Foreman, who has been a brave and courageous spokesman for the Earth. Those who know Dave and his lifelong legacy know that he speaks up for the Earth, and he still does, with a voice that pulls no punches. Currently, Dave Foreman directs the Rewilding Institute, a bold initiative with a visionary's punch that says we've got to restore the structures of the wild, particularly in the West, as you'll hear now, as Dave continues with his 16th in a series, Around the Campfire. So now, Dave speaks about the Angry West. Dave Foreman.
Hello and welcome to issue 16 of Uncle Dave Foreman's Around the Campfire. This issue is titled, The Angry West. The Angry West, get off our backs, Uncle Sam, was the cover of Newsweek in one of their issues in 1979. Beginning with this Newsweek cover story in 1979, complete with a clenched-jawed Marlboro man on horseback, ill-informed East Coast journalists began to peddle carefully fermented wine of the Western economic elite that the West was dead set against conservation and public lands. Of all the lies, myths, and blather that come from the anti-conservationists, this war on the West bullshit most ticks me off, probably because of my personal history. I'm sick and tired of scheming industry, pandering politicians, whiny rednecks, and benighted East Coast journalists playing the victimized West card. I was born in New Mexico. My family homesteaded here over 100 years ago. I am a Westerner by damn, and I know how phony the war on the West claims are. In a recent Around the Campfire, I wrote about anti-public land bullies during the first half of the 20th century. What we have been hearing about the War on the West since the 1970s is just a continuation of these kind of rip-offs on the public land. And they've been very good at resurrecting the effective victimization cry behind earlier attacks on the public lands. In this campfire, we'll take on the advertising-like spin of the Keystone Sob of Western anti-conservationists. In my forthcoming War on Nature book, and perhaps in future campfires, I'll delve more into the anti-conservation movement. The War on the West rhetoric makes it sound like nearly all Westerners and rural folks dislike wilderness area designation, protection of endangered species, reintroduction of wolves and other carnivores, and public lands in general, including national parks and national forests. I've just been told by a Western Canadian conservationist that all this goes on up there as well. The truth is that a loud and big bucks mighty minority, some of their employees, their beholden politicians, and a small number of throwback ranchers and fearful populace, bumpkin proletarians, do oppose protection of public land. But most of the folks in the West, urban and rural, prize public land and find them to be a vital part of what makes the West the West. Nonetheless, the War on the West claim is made so often and so shrilly that many fall for it, even in the West, even among a few newly arrived or naive conservationists. Carl Hess Jr. warns that, quote, wise users have sunk their roots in agrarian tradition and righteously demanded that the West be preserved exclusively for Westerners, a catchphrase that roughly translates into ranchers, loggers, and miners, end quote. Some academics also fall into this trap, with one Western Cal College political scientist offering such claptrap as, quote, the idea of wilderness has always been advanced by those who can afford it, not by those who can live it, end quote. Based on my lifetime in the West, I'd say this comment reveals the professor as the true elitist outsider who doesn't know what he's talking about. As far back as you wish to go in the history of wilderness area protection, Westerners with thorough knowledge of the land have been the muddy boots on the ground experts, as well as much of the leadership for the designation of national parks and wilderness areas. Who has it been for over 100 years to explore the back of beyond? Draw the map boundaries based on their footwork, give the talks and slideshows, and work their tails off to push agencies and politicians to safeguard wild places. It has overwhelmingly been locals. Even in the 1970s campaign for the Alaska Lands Act, where nature lovers from all over the country came out in support, much of the knowledge and leadership was from Fairbanks, Juneau, Anchorage, and the bush. And let's quit being silly about elitism. Just about anyone can afford to go to nearby wilderness areas. For example, anybody in Albuquerque with bus fare can easily and quickly get to a trailhead for the Sandia Mountains Wilderness Area. I was dirt poor in my late teens to 30s, as were my friends. Yet we got out to wildernesses all over the United States. Loggers, ranchers, and bulldozer jockeys had newer pickups and made plenty more money than most of my band of wilderness warriors. The difference was that they endlessly blubbered about their economic plight to anyone who would listen, while we just went on with our modest lives, figuring that only people of low character whined about such things. Overall, conservationists are middle class. Well-to-do conservationists do exist, of course, but an honest person can't build the elitist claim on these few. It's the dishonest and ill-informed who have cooked up such a falsehood. Gobbling up such whoppers are the anti-intellectual and paranoid set who weave them into outlandish conspiracy theories. University of Wyoming political scientist McGregor Colley also muddles things when he writes about President Jimmy Carter's 1977 bid to kill 8 pork barrel water projects in the West. Quote, immediate reaction throughout the West portrays Carter's move as a direct attack on the region. End quote. What the professor doesn't fully explain is that this so-called immediate reaction came from the irrigation elite and their political thralls, not from the common citizens of the West, who were mixed in their reactions. For over a decade, many of us Westerners had been fighting the welfare dams Carter ditched. In fact, opposition to these water projects originated with homegrown Western conservation groups, river runners, and sport fishers, not with President Carter. I know. I was there helping to spark the fight 6 years before Carter's action. Those hooked on dams and canals, along with slapdash reporters, successfully spun Carter's action as something suddenly sprung on the West from the District of Columbia. They overlooked public meetings, demonstrations, and detailed comments and water project environmental impact statements from local river runners and lovers. In 1971, I started working against Cochiti Dam on the Rio Grande, New Mexico. In 1973, I sent out the invitation letter for a Denver meeting that organized the American Rivers Conservation Alliance, now called American Rivers. So I have some understanding of what was going on in the 1970s. Carter's action came in big part from those of us in the West who fought dams, not from bow-tied policy wonks on the Potomac. We Western conservationists know all this, or should, but the news media slights us in order to tell a more red-hot story. A good example of how the establishment media turns its ear from those who don't fit into the war on the West myth they wish to keep going comes from Larry Calloway, New Mexico's most distinguished and reliable journalist, now retired. In 1996, he reported in his newspaper column, quote, "We think it's wonderful," said Celeste Bernards, co-owner of Escalante's only outdoor sports outfitter. Quote, "It's good for us. It's good for the community. Our business here is catering to tourism, and we've broken our butts for 8 years to build a store," end quote. But she said with some bitterness that she's expressed this opinion to at least 20 journalists and never seems to make the news because, quote, "they want to hear the dirt and we're positive about it," end quote. Bernards was talking about the Escalante Grand Staircase National Monument in Utah, which got loads of coverage in the mid-1990s as a showcase study of government brutality on rural communities. The national media have puffed up this war on the West fairy tale, and land barons and industry bigwigs must be chortling about what naive city slickers reporters are. Many local opponents of the Escalante Grand Staircase National Monument, by the way, are now happy with the deal. War on the West flim-flam was blown out of the water once again in 1995, with a survey to measure support for reintroduction of the Mexican wolf in New Mexico. Jerry Maricini, New Mexico Game and Fish director, killed a contract to poll New Mexicans and then publicly opposed wolf reintroduction because, quote, "local support in those counties with the best potential wolf habitat is practically non-existent," end quote. Unbowed, we wolf supporters raised private money, and the League of Women Voters commissioned the polling firm Responsive Management to go ahead. Quote, "the results of the poll came as a surprise to some state officials who expected stiffer opposition in rural counties," end quote, said one newspaper article. Why? Well, 61% statewide and 49.5% in 4 rural counties near the wolf release area favored reintroduction of Mexican wolves and the Apache National Forest. Practically non-existent local support? Of course, the livestock industry, not representing all ranchers, by the way, wailed their disbelief. Mike Duda, executive director of Responsive Management, explained that like results had been found elsewhere. For example, 60% of rural residents in Idaho and Montana backed reintroduction of the grizzly bear to the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness Area, despite strong opposition from the two states' politicians. And 75% of the residents around the Osceola National Forest in northern Florida favored reintroduction of the Florida panther. Duda said, quote, "What I think it means is that a small minority, the unenvironmental extremists, are so vocal that they appear to represent a larger portion of the population than they really do," end quote. Duda could not be more right. The myth that the West and rural America are wholly against wolves, wilderness, and public lands is a bald-faced, self-serving, conscious lie. It has been shown wrong time after time. 19th century economic and political elite in the West pretends to speak for the rest of us. They do not. Nonetheless, greenhorns who write for the national media eat it up and serve it to their readers. Of course there is angry opposition to protection of public lands and wildlife in the West. But despite its noise, it does not represent the majority. For over 100 years, there have been homegrown conservationists fighting the foes of conservation. That is the real story. One of the best observations on the whole Western myth was written in 1979 by a thoughtful East Coast journalist. Quote, "There is something quaint about the Westerner's insistence that he built the place all by his lonesome, with no help from God or the socialistic East. The myth is that men were brave, women were fair, and life was sweet before the tea-sipping, paper-pushing dudes from Washington started butting in." The author, George Will, commenting on the Sagebrush Rebellion appropriately in the 1979 Angry West issue of Newsweek. Nearly three decades later, little has changed. I've been closely watching the ongoing use of the war on the West during this time. I believe that the overriding reason it still has legs is because the mainstream East Coast media have fallen for the myth and endlessly parrot it. Both print and electronic news media have been grossly unprofessional and irresponsible in not digging deeper and talking to a wider sweep of Westerners. If reporters and other journalists would do the job they're supposed to do, the stories would be about exposing the falseness of the war on the West. One reason the media have been so sloppy with this issue, however, is that we, pro-public lands Westerners, have let them get away with it. We have not been loud enough, persistent enough, and angry enough to set the record straight. It's high time the conservationists quit being cowed by the quaint myth, and damn it as the lie it is. We must endlessly straighten out the reporters, publications, and bloggers who stupidly repeat it. By roaring about this and other anti-conservation myths and lies, we will crack through the numbskulls in the media and make it more likely that our side is told too. Remember that every time the War on the West myth is repeated in public, it gains more credibility. Our task as conservationists is to never allow it to go unchallenged. It's high time for angry conservationists. Stay Foreman. Good night.
Thank you, Dave. You know, there's a lot of pressure these days to become happy environmentalists as we see the clean tech amalgamation forming. It is, without doubt, the emerging critical mass for environmental change that has been growing for the past 40 years. We all deserve a standing ovation for this great evolution of thought on the planet. And yet, we must, as Dave makes clear, bring along all the players, including those well-worn, booted infantry who've been fighting in the woods and prairies, slogging through the riverbanks and estuaries, heading off along the trails, and heading off across country into the wildest places on earth. Because they have to. It is their land. Nature and the environment must now forge ahead together. Thanks, Dave, for the course correction. We'll return next week with our next weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. This past week, the National Mall in the nation's capital was festooned with 20 amazing homes, each of which had to be entirely powered by the sun. We'll learn more about that and tell you how you can participate in this year's National Solar Tour when your Voice of the Earth returns. We'll keep the light on.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's no longer alternative energy. It's the future of energy itself. Sun, wind, geothermal, biomass, waves, and more. You are now entering the new energy age, or at least you will. Lots of people are already building and retrofitting their homes to reap the rewards of wise resource design. The National Solar Tour invites you to hop on board when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. This past month, the National Mall in the nation's capital was filled with 20 solar homes, each of which was designed by competing college and university design teams in a competition sponsored by BP Solar and the Department of Energy. It was the latest solar decathlon. Each home was competing to prove that they could provide the greatest comfort and compatibility for a typical family, including lights, heat, air controls, kitchens, bathrooms, real livable homes, and all the energy had to come from the sun. Wish I had been able to be there, but the show closed up last week. But the National Solar Tour continues in states across the nation, giving every one of you the chance to see what people in your neighborhood are doing to turn their homes into energy-efficient, global-friendly, solar-integrated spaces for living. Today, we'll be talking with Michael DeGrazia, who is managing this two-month national showcase of the National Solar Tour. That's coming up. But first, we bring you this week's Nature News. So now, the news. President Bush on Friday vetoed a major water resources development bill which authorized $23 billion for projects ranging from restoration projects in the Everglades and storm-ravaged Louisiana to myriads of other water projects at a time when serious discussions of water wars are emerging between water-rich states and those being impacted by drought and water shortages. The president said he was compelled to veto the legislation, which had bipartisan support, because it was too rich in overexpenditures and pork. The vetoed bill is expected to be returned to the House and Senate, where it is expected to be passed with congressional overrides of the president's veto. Entergy Corp., the second-largest U.S. nuclear power generation firm, announced Monday that it plans to spin off 5 nuclear power plants into a new company, capitalizing on the greenhouse gas-friendly energy source. The U.S. nuclear power industry is seeing a resurgence of interest due in large part to the governmental regulations which will create incentives for the development of carbon-limiting sources of energy. All the plants are being planned for the eastern states, including Massachusetts, New York, Michigan, and Vermont. With the class of amphibians facing dramatic impacts from various environmental threats, it has been announced that an antibiotic used in humans to combat pink eye offers a significant defense against the chytridiomycosis fungus that is devastating portions of the frog communities. Currently, at least one-third of all species are facing serious population decreases and even extinction due to the threats from human and natural causes. The news brings hope to the challenges faced to turn the tides of extinction sweeping through the class of amphibians. However, with the good news comes the real-world challenge of how to apply the treatment to frog communities without causing secondary and tertiary side effects. Much of the research is being conducted by the San Diego Zoological Society in California. And finally, Washo, the wild-born chimpanzee, who was ultimately raised by R. Allen and Beatrix Gardner, and who had learned to communicate using the American Sign Language, the hand gestures used by many deaf people to communicate, died at the age of 42. Washo's behaviors raised wild debate in the 60s and 70s about animal intelligence, with many skeptics claiming that Washo was, in reality, a glorified circus act and did not really understand the gestures and meanings of her signing. But Washo persisted, teaching an infant chimp to sign, which led to a small community of chimps who taught one another signing and signed when no humans were present. Washo inspired the work of Francine Patterson and her work with Coco, the gorilla, who learned over 1,000 signs. Further research has opened the door to the current understanding by leading primatologists that chimps, bonobos, gorillas, and other higher primates have a very complex reasoning and feeling dynamic. Animals all over the planet owe a moment of silence to honor the benefits Washo made in human-animal communication. And that's the news. And a few reminders. You're probably aware that the Wildside News is now airing its newest shows each Tuesday, giving you more time throughout the week to listen and learn from the many people who add their voices each week to the Wildside News. If you have questions or would like to have your name added to our mailing list to receive weekly show updates, please send an email to wildsidenews@cox.net. That's WILDSIDENEWS at COX.NET. You'll be glad you did. And now to today's feature. This last month on the nation's capital, the National Mall, there was a competition open to universities to create literal solar homes. And the mall had 20 homes constructed on-site to demonstrate the effectiveness and the advances in solar technologies, and it was quite stunning. I wish that I had been there. As someone who has built a solar home a long time ago, I'd like to see what's happening now. They just finished the competition and announced the winners, and we'll have links to that information on the website. Solar has a lot of history. It certainly is becoming a very current technology that people are integrating, really thinking about incorporating into new homes and also retrofitting their existing homes. It's happening all over the country, and that's what's kind of exciting, and that's why right now we're going to talk with Michael DeGrazia, who is the tour manager for the American Solar Energy Society, their national solar tour. Michael, welcome to the Wildside News.
Well, thank you, Sydney.
Let's first of all talk a little bit about the American Solar Energy Society, and then I'd like to get into the tour, and we'll go from there.
The American Solar Energy Society is a nonprofit organization. We're dedicated to increasing the use of solar energy, energy efficiency, and other sustainable energy technologies in the U.S. We're founded in 1954 and now supported by more than 10,000 members across the nation who to work together to help create a sustainable energy economy. Together with ACES regional chapters in 36 states, we work together to provide a powerful collaboration to move legislation and move the country in a sustainable energy direction.
Let's talk about the website, too.
Well, the website is for the American Solar Energy Society is www.ases.org. The program that I manage is a national solar tour, and you put a slash tour after that, or you can go directly there by nationalsolartour.org.
This is the 2007 tour. It was initiated in October and is continuing through November, and it's happening in how many states across the country?
This year we hit 46 states, plus D.C., plus Puerto Rico. We added several states from last year. We anticipate to be in all 50 states next year.
That's sensational. And when you go to the ases.org website, you'll be able to find your state and find out things that are happening. And there's a lot going on. Why don't you tell people how they can participate?
The actual tour date, the official tour date, is always the first Saturday of October, which is National Energy Awareness Month. So while the official tour date has passed, a few tours are continuing into November. In some states, for example, Arizona, they do a different tour in a different city throughout the state throughout the October and into November. But for the most part, you can find tours by going to the ACES website and clicking on the National Solar Tour logo. And then the individual tour information, including any fees, would be listed by state. So, example, if I was to click on California and then I'd click on my area, it would take me to the tour information that that tour organizer on the ground has posted.
The theme for this year's tour is?
Is real places for real people.
Why don't you explain why you're promoting that concept right now?
Many people have the misconception that solar is something off into the future, that it's not financially viable, that the technology isn't reliable. Well, those may be true from the past, maybe 10 or 20 years ago. Technology and the companies involved in the technology have advanced so far that the current manufacturing techniques are applied. The economies of scale have brought the price down. The reliability is there, and people in real places that you can go and visit can show you how that they are living with sustainable energy technologies.
I know for myself, I used solar back in the 80s and 90s, had solar panels outside my house in a remote area of New Mexico. I was off the grid, so I had no choice. And it was thrilling to be able to wake up and utilize my home and my appliances, as well at night, my lighting. But it was really kind of crude because I had to store all of my electricity in batteries. We've come a long way since then. Why don't you give a sense of where solar is these days, where it's moving, and what people can look forward to?
A lot of people are off-grid, and they like to be off-grid, but that's really a small percentage of the buildings that are on the tour. The current survey data I have from homeowners, just a small sample of those homeowners participating, roughly 400 who answered the survey so far, about 14% are off-grid. Many of them are grid-connected and getting checks back from the utility company in an arrangement called net metering, where they're watching their utility meter spin backwards. So they're essentially not storing the energy in batteries. They're using the utility as their battery. So they're putting excess energy into the utility, into the grid, during daylight hours while they're at work and the sun's up high, creating energy. And at night, they come home and they turn on their TV and the radio and whatnot and use their appliances and use more energy, and the net balance might be zero.
And by the way, that I'm sure is one of your major campaigns is to add additional states or even locales that allow net metering, because that is the practical way to do this. It's a plus and a minus on your monthly bill.
Oh, that's true. The American Solar Energy Society works through chapters, and they're the boots on the ground. And we help those chapters connect with each other to share stories and what works and what doesn't work, and basically to help move states forward in developing net metering laws. Thanks. People can find information on their state and net metering laws at findsolar.com or from the DSIRE USA.org database, an organization in North Carolina.
Now, the National Solar Tour that is going on right now is not just about solar energy. It really is solar systems, which advances into areas of lighting and heating and applications and appliances. Why don't you give me some highlights and where people may be able to go these days to see what's happening in terms of these integrated systems, not just solar panels on a roof?
Well, the solar panels on the roof really aren't the first step in becoming a sustainable household. The first step is improving the energy efficiency of appliances or taking on some conservation methods for yourself. I'm looking at the results from the homeowners, roughly 400, and it's pretty consistent year over year. Energy Star appliances are installed in 65% of those respondent homes. Insulating windows also 65%. So the first thing to do is lower your load, decrease the amount of energy that you need. It's a lot less expensive to get energy-efficient appliances than to put more solar panels on the roof, for example.
That's exactly right. For example, some people even use solar to power a refrigerator. Refrigerators are a huge drain on solar systems, and therefore it's really practical. First, you save a lot of money by just buying a much more efficient refrigerator, and there are some truly efficient fridges out there right now.
Many states and utilities offer rebates if you bring an old refrigerator and you drop it off to them. But you'd have to go into the one of those mentioned websites to find out what your state and locales have for rebates. Also, passive solar is very big. Could be simply orienting a building, a new building, in the right direction. Solar tubes are big, too. People have done studies to find that the effects of sunlight are very positive on the human psyche. I believe Walmart did a study where they built half a building using solar tubes, and they ran out of money for solar tubes, and they did the other half with fluorescent lights. Well, they found that the sales were much better in the half of the building with solar tubes, so they switched the inventory, and they found that that side with the solar tubes still had much higher sales.
Some people may not be familiar with that term, solar tubes. Fascinating, very practical application for bringing light, really fabulous light into the house, but give us a brief overview of what that means.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's where the you'll have, it's like a skylight, but it's a diffused light, so you're not getting a direct sunlight into the house. And if you look up and you see a solar tube, the lighting installation, you can't tell that it's not a light, except that it's a full-spectrum light. People pay $25 for a full-spectrum light bulb. It's a lot healthier just to have a solar tube in your house.
They're controllable. You can change the aperture or the openings. If you want to decrease the light, you can control that.
You know, it's really fascinating what's available. And a lot of these things are things I've only seen for the first time in the past year. By attending tours myself. But by going to tours, you see that these are real technologies. They're installed in real people's homes, and you hear it from the mouth of the homeowner. And they're the best advocates because, hey, you know, if it didn't work, they'd tell 10 people. If it does work, they might tell one or two, but through the National Solar Tour, they're able to tell thousands.
What I find interesting, I've been on a recent solar tour here in San Diego. When you go to these solar tours, these are homeowners. Very often homeowners or small business owners or even corporate owners. And you get your questions answered. Real specific questions. I know I was at one and people were talking about, for example, solar water heaters. And the guy was saying, well, you know, you can buy some of these things on Craigslist. Sometimes they're given away free. So there's lots of really, as you say, real places for real people. There's terrific information that comes from literally visiting homes.
Right, and it helps to get through the muddle. They tell you directly, what was the cost? How did you install it? What problems have you had? What issues did you have with your utility? And it clears the pathway for ownership. Roughly 30% of people who have these systems installed and are now on tours were influenced by their experience at past solar tours. So it's a significant part of the information a homeowner collects along the way before their decision to make the purchase decision.
And from your experience, how do you think most people get started? You mentioned, you know, just trying to, first of all, conserve, but some people start out differently. I'm just curious what your perspective is on kind of what motivates people to get started and how they begin.
Well, I ask questions on both the guest survey and the homeowner survey about what influences their decisions. What influences the guest's decision to come visit a tour? What influences the homeowner's decision to install the technology? By far the largest influence is to reduce global carbon emissions and climate change. And that's the concern that is foremost on the minds of Americans and other people around the world, especially those people attending tours. These are people who are doing something about it. They're not sitting by and waiting for someone else, Uncle Sam, to come by and save them. they're taking the action to say, I'm going to reduce my carbon footprint. The second is energy independence. A lot of people want to have energy if the grid goes down. We've got tour organizers in Louisiana who've experienced hurricanes before Hurricane Andrew specifically. Jeff Shaw installed solar panels on his home in Baton Rouge. And that home became a place for victims of Hurricane Katrina to take a shower and listen to the news and get a hot meal, when all the other homes around them were out of power and all the generators were out of gas.
It's a concept of sustainability in its most pure form, which is survivability. Let's talk a little bit about costs and efficiencies. I know that in the past, people would basically sort of assume that a solar system had about a 20-year payout. Is that changing? In other words, it would take about 20 years to offset the cost. Is that changing at this point?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people look at it in terms of cost. And it depends on the local utility, state rebates, and the federal government. Federal tax law currently allows up to $2,000 rebate for a solar hot water system or a solar PV system or both. So up to $4,000 for a household. That might change, and there's a petition that the people can sign on the ACES website so that those incentives don't go away. That can bring the payback down significantly. We have a website, findsolar.com, where people can go and get a quick back-of-the-envelope type estimate that includes the rebates for their local area, their utility, and so forth, that can give them a ballpark figure. But by and large, people have different motivations for installing these. I've heard people, homeowners, tell me that the payback was the day that they had the system installed because they turned the lights on and they knew that they were not emitting carbon into the atmosphere by their choice of electricity.
That is a big payout, and a lot of people are committing to that, realize that it's up to us and that we all must do this. And an interesting aspect of this, too, is the fact that as we start integrating these into our homes and our communities, there's a lot of jobs that are being created. That's a huge future for America right now. We need sort of a new direction, I really believe. And energy independence is the singular most effective way to really re-energize, literally, America right now. Do you have any information about how this may be affecting jobs into our future?
This Thursday on the 11th of November, we're coming out with a Green Collar Jobs Report. American Solar Energy Society has commissioned this first of its kind jobs report that looks at what the current jobs are in America related to a sustainable energy economy and what they could be with appropriate policy. For years, we've known that renewable energy is important for the environment, but now we know the critical role it plays in boosting the economy and creating jobs. Right now, we have about 8.5 million jobs in the United States in both energy efficiency and renewable energy. But with the appropriate policies, that number can jump to 40 million by 2030. And that report will be available as a free download from ACES.org, A-S-E-S.org.
Wouldn't that be great to have that level of people involved in creating sustainability and energy efficiency in America?
It also results in homeowners having more money for themselves to spend on the things that they need, health care, clothes, entertainment, and whatnot, because they won't be spending that money for heating their homes or for powering their appliances. They'll have energy-efficient appliances and insulated homes that are part of this economy. And with the right policies and rebates in place, people will have the incentives to make those changes in their current homes.
Well, it's a wise decision. A couple of specifics. I'm just curious now. You mentioned heating. What's happening? What are some of the trends that you're finding or new developments in terms of heating? Because it's very difficult to heat a house with solar electric heating. But what are some options for people these days? What are people developing?
Well, there's new and there's old. I mean, there's technologies that are well documented from the Roman times, namely passive solar heating, where you orient the building or you put windows on the side of the house that has the greatest solar exposure and thermal masses, Trumbull walls, that sort of thing. Building home with the use of solar integrated technology so that it's not a retrofit, which costs more. But you have the tubes in the walls that you need to have, for example, radiant floor heating, mm-hmm. where you're not heating the air in the house, you're heating the floor in the house, and that in turn heats the furniture and everything else, so it's nice and cozy.
That's actually done through solar collectors that heat water. That's
water or glycol, yes.
Yes, exactly right. There's a new facility being built here in San Diego that quite a large facility, and they have these wonderful solar collectors that, as you say, heat large storage tanks of glycol or water or a mix, and that gets pumped into the flooring And that's the best heating there is, because the heat generates at the floor and then rises.
Right.
It's very, very steady heating.
And I've seen also on tours solar air heaters, which is essentially a bread box with a copper plate inside, and of course a window, and it heats up like a mini greenhouse and then pumps hot air into the house.
So practical. What's interesting is the way in which Ingenuity is going to start to really integrate all of these different systems. LED lighting, what an enormous advance. When I was utilizing solar, lighting was the big issue, and at that time, my only option really were about 25-watt, 50-watt incandescent bulbs, which just drained my battery systems. But now, with 1- and 2-watt LED lighting, you get tremendous amounts of quality light. You know, the footprint that will be required in the future here for the literal solar panels is probably going to start going down as our requirements to keep our homes functioning is lessened by all of these advances.
Exactly. And people don't have to give up their lifestyle necessarily to make these great advancements in reducing their energy load. There are things that people can do right now. I bought a little device I plug into the wall, and I plug it into the appliance, and it tells me how many watts I'm using. Well, when I bought a LED TV or LCD TV, I discovered quickly that it had some energy-saving features on it. By this little device, it told me how many watts I was using.
That's a really cool thing. What's the name of that? I know that, for example, in San Diego here, you can go to your regional energy office, and they'll lend you one of these things, and you hook up a device to this thing, and it tells you exactly how much energy that device is consuming, comparing TVs in your house, for example.
Mm-hmm. I know that there's a brand that I used, and there may be other brands. It's called a kilowatt, as in kill a watt.
Uh-huh, great.
So I'm sure if you Google that, you might be able to find that. And I've got one plugged into the copy machine here. We're doing an assessment on how much energy we can save by hitting that energy saver button when we're not using it.
Oh, that's cool. Any information that you find kind of startling in terms of energy use based on your little device?
Well, I was surprised to find how much energy it takes to make a copy. And we don't think about that. But when we start breaking it down in terms of how much energy do I need to survive, maybe I can make a few less copies.
There you go. Every time you can conserve it, it makes a difference. And now, in terms of the tour itself, I'm just curious if there's anything that really has fascinated you, that's really captured your attention, that you'd like to tell people about and encourage them to go to see.
More than a few things.
Let's talk about that.
I'd say number one is the homeowners. I thank the homeowners, and we all thank the homeowners, because they're the ones stepping forward and saying, hey, I've got a house. I can show my neighbors through your event how they can save money. And this is a grassroots event with roughly 4,000 to 5,000 homes around the country, the 46 states, as I mentioned, 50 next year I'm shooting for. but the homeowners are the ones who are the really driving this. Those people have the real places. They want to show other people what's here and now, what has arrived in terms of your choices for energy and energy efficiency. There are tours around the country. I mentioned Louisiana is impressive. The Cold Climate Housing Research Center in Alaska and Fairbanks is part of the tour as well. You'd think, well, they don't have much sun up there, but they've got some pretty good solar resources during times of the year. Other times of the year, they use a hybrid system, part solar and mostly wind. And they're big into showing people how they can save energy and stay warm and stay alive in a very harsh environment by implementing energy efficiency technologies. Washington State comes to mind, tremendous growth. A very inspired group of people there, Oregon as well, where the people on the ground, the homeowners and the community leaders are leading this. There are many utilities involved as well. It's a lot cheaper to implement energy efficiency than to build a new coal power plant. We see a lot of the utilities moving away from sources that are dangerous to the environment or for national security toward positive clean energy technologies that promote jobs and growth locally. And keep the dollars in your pocket in the end, which is what's going to help drive this economy.
As I go through the interview here, I was about to ask you if you had any websites where people could go to get information. I'm not going to ask you that question. I'm going to encourage people to just go to the ases.org website and go to a tour. Isn't that what we really want?
Absolutely. And through the ases.org website, they can find their local chapters where they can meet people who are like-minded, who are making the changes, and how they can help to make the changes within their own area, or how to bring the reality of ownership to more people in their area. I have linked on the National Solar Tour website some resources that were recommended by other organizers, namely links to the Department of Energy, Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy, Energy Star website, Building America website, Alliance to Save Energy, American Council for Energy Efficient Economy. It's really a website I've put together to help researchers and interested in individuals who need that extra information to analyze their decision to invest. Information on carbon emissions and climate change, including the IPCC report. So going right to the heart of the matter, the Stern Review on economics of climate change, things that can really help drive change if people are aware that it makes sense, and it makes sense right now, to move toward an energy-efficient, sustainable energy economy.
I have to assume that there are some stories of people who, after going on the tour, decide that it's time to just plain, it really gives them the incentive to move forward. Are you hearing some stories like that?
I get those stories from the people who are on the tour this year. As I mentioned, roughly 30% of homeowners were influenced in some way by a previous tour experience. What is the single greatest source of inspiration that led to your investment in sustainable energy? That's the question I asked the homeowners. Some of the answers I have: if you can afford it, it is simply the right thing to do. Aim to leave this planet a little better than you found it. Another person says the Northeast power outage in August of 2003 was their single greatest source of inspiration. Somebody else mentioned Colorado Amendment 37 and associated rebates, so financial incentive there.
You know, another thing, too, I'm sure a lot of families are heading out, and people who utilize solar at this point in their life are really doing the best thing they possibly can for the children. Because if we're facing these kinds of crises right now that we're talking about in terms of energy prices reaching, it's going to be $100 a barrel of oil here fairly soon, as well as our mountaintops are being removed, our natural places are being ripped up for energy exploitation, and there are options. The best thing a person can do when you're on a solar tour is look around at the children and realize that to a large extent, you're really serving them well.
That message is very important. And I like the commercial I saw, and I don't recall what group put it together, a television commercial where someone's standing and saying, what, global warming, that's not going to happen for 30 years. I'll be dead and gone by then. He steps out of the way, and behind him is a small child and a train right behind that child coming right at her.
A powerful message.
I might mention also, we are posting, due to popular demand, tours that are happening other months of the year. So people can come back to that website and find tours from January through August. There are not as many. Roughly 80% of tours happen on the National Solar Tour Day, with a few left in November. But we're expanding that so that people can come to the website if they're interested in finding tours that are opening their doors throughout the year.
Having been on tours, I'm telling you, it's a great way to spend a Saturday or a Sunday or some other day, because there's nothing like actually seeing what's happening with these new technologies. Michael DeGrazia, tour manager for the American Solar Energy Society, at www.ases.org. I wish you great success. You've done a great job, and I encourage everybody to head on out throughout the month of November here and find out where things are happening in your local area by going to that website.
Thank you for the interview very much, Sydney.
Just a reminder, there are 365 days until election 2008. Make good use of your time. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Tuesday or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world. Here on the Wild Side News.